Welcome back, constant listeners. This is the Far Middle Podcast. Let's get right into it. Our dedication for episode 46 is going to go to Doug Plank, that hard-hitting safety for the Bears in the late 70s and 80s. What, you might ask, Doug Plank, who? Well, you see, sort of Doug Plank. Our dedication this episode is going to be something a little bit different than the norm. It's not going to be a player, so sorry, Lee Smith, apologies to you. I mean, you would have deserved it, but we're not going to go with you on this one. But instead, we're going to dedicate episode 46 to a revolutionary defense in football that was devised by an outspoken, brash coordinator who is an NFL legend. I'm speaking of the 46 defense and of the great Chicago Bears team from 1985 and that incomparable Buddy Ryan, who was the defensive coordinator. Now, the 46 defense, it disrupted the game. It disrupted it literally. It disrupted it figuratively, for sure. And what the 46 defense was, it placed six defensive players on the line of scrimmage. Two of them were linebackers. And then that left two linebackers behind them and three defensive backs for 11 total. Today, you look at the 46 defense, it seems like such a simple adjustment. But when it first was unveiled, it caught the entire league by surprise. And for a long time, it looked like there wasn't going to be any stopping the 46 defense. The name for the defense wasn't derived from the standard convention of the number of linemen versus linebackers. So what you sort of see with the 4-3 or the 3-4 defense. Instead, the name came from the jersey number of safety Doug Plank, who was on the squad when Buddy Ryan developed the 46 defense with the Bears. So like I said, this is dedicated to not just the 46 defense, but in a way also to Doug Plank, probably the most impactful player in football history that you never heard of. And incidentally, Plank is a Western Pennsylvania native. He grew up about a half hour from where I'm sitting right now, half hour's drive. Now, you don't see the 46 defense anymore. So why don't we see it anymore? Because football is like a lot of things in life. One disruption and one innovation leads to a counter innovation. Nothing remains static. And although the 46 defense was deadly against that two running back, two receiver offensive set, teams adjusted, and they started running spread offenses that basically killed the 46 defense. But in 1985, there was no way to score on the 46 defense. The Bears won 15-1 that season. Their only loss was to the Dolphins and Dan Marino on Monday Night Football. Some of you old enough certainly remember that game. That game that night had two Pittsburgh natives going at it, Dan Marino, of course, and Coach Mike Ditka, who was coaching the Bears. Jim McMahon didn't start for the Bears that night, still speculated to this day as to why. He might have been having too much fun, maybe, down in Miami. And the Dolphins were playing to protect the legacy of that 1972 undefeated team. If you ask Dan Marino today, he's still on the record as saying his greatest accomplishment in his career was that win to protect the 72's undefeated status. Also in that game, Ditka, the head coach, right, for the Bears, and Buddy Ryan, the defensive coordinator, they almost came to blows in the Orange Bowl tunnel at halftime during that game. There was always a certain degree of, I guess you'd call it chemistry, between the two of them, Ditka and Ryan. Ryan would later in his career throw another punch at a coach during a game. So here's a trivia question. Who did Buddy Ryan throw a punch at during a game later after that, that 85 Bears team? Answer is Kevin Gilbride. Both of them were coordinators with the Oilers at the time. Buddy was the defensive coordinator. Gilbride was the offensive coordinator. And the Dolphins' loss that the Bears suffered that Monday night in Miami, it really didn't matter in the end when it came to the 1985 Bears. They destroyed their way through the playoffs, crushed the Patriots in the Super Bowl. Still upset that Walter Payton didn't get a chance to score a touchdown in the Super Bowl because in part, Ditka decided to run Fridge Perry to score at the goal line. But that aside, there's just a dominant run that the 85 Bears ensued upon. So episode 46, it goes to Doug Plank. It goes to Buddy Ryan, both of them by way of helping to name and make the 46 defense the legend that it is today. All right, so let's start connecting some dots in this episode. The 46 defense, it puts offenses on the run for a while, and then the offenses adapted, and they made the 46 defense extinct. Same thing is happening with a lot of virtue signaling and mandates that are tied to pandemic management. They are collapsing like a house of cards. The latest example that I saw that I wanted to talk about with you is what's going on in New York City, whose leadership, unfortunately at times, is an illustration of what it looks like when you have the left running things. So you remember all those mandates in New York City for city workers, for visitors going to Manhattan, for restaurant patrons, and also for pro athletes. Kyrie Irving for the Brooklyn Nets not being able to play home games in Brooklyn, that was a big example, a big case in point. So guess what happens when someone like Kyrie doesn't play home games and he's the star player? Ticket sales, viewership, those things start to plummet. And baseball season's coming with the same problems that are going to affect the Mets and the Yankees. And then you got performers, whether it's concerts or other, who won't play New York City and instead will play in close by New Jersey or Connecticut or upstate New York. Well, now the mayor, Mayor Adams, says no more vaccine mandates for athletes and performers, which is good to see some rationality take root, albeit it's way, way too late in the game itself. It should have happened way sooner. The heavy-handed state mandate happy era of pandemic, it's starting to crumble. I guess that's a good way of saying long live individual freedoms. And just to repeat, I've gone on the record in the past. I want to do it again. I am pro-vaccine, anti-mandate. I am all for protecting the most vulnerable in society. I'm also against mass shutdowns. They do much more harm than good. None of this is politics. It's just common sense coupled with a respect of individual liberty. But there are also two problems with Mayor Adams' move here. Two really big problems, frankly. First, New York City still has vaccine mandates in effect for city workers. So you look at something like janitors at the arenas and stadiums we're talking about, they're subjected to things like vaccine mandates, which is more than ironic. Firemen and cops, who, by the way, are those same workers that showed up for their shifts when there was no vaccine, while the celebrity athletes were sequestered in their mansions and penthouses, they are subjected to the vaccine mandates. And the mandate also applies to attendees to events. You still can't attend the Met Opera if you're not vaccinated, or even if you are vaccinated, but you don't want to present your vaccination card and disclose health information, which, by the way, is a massive invasion of privacy. Second big problem with what Mayor Adams did here is that this exemption shows how our society values the spectacle more than the substance. And that's a subject or a theme that I highlighted in my book, Precipice, The Left's Campaign to Destroy America, which is out now. You can purchase it or order it and read it. But that's a theme that I hit upon in the book. So Mayor Adams, right, he's worried sick over what his vaccine mandate would impact when it comes to the Mets or the Yankees or the Nets records. But as to what it does to the staffing of firemen when the city fires or terminates unvaccinated workers, who cares? You know, keep the mandate in. It's good optics. Sports and concert performers, they end up getting more respect and more choice, more freedom, more leeway than the working men and women who really make the city run, function, and provide a safe environment. So that's more irony considering the mayor was an NYPD officer earlier in his career. So I guess on one level, you know, the lifting of the mandate for athletes and performers, that's good. Happy to see that. But the other side of this, on another level, it shows how the elite have one set of rules for them, and then the rest of us have to live with a very different, less free set of rules that are much more stifling. That makes no sense. That is not equitable. But that's what happens when the elite and or the left run things like they have in New York City. So let's move on to the next dot. It's another strange thing that happens when the left is running the show. And this one deals with what our president said about 2 weeks ago at a Democratic National Committee fundraiser. So I'm going to quote what he said, and I apologize if it's choppy, but I don't want to misquote him. He said, quote, "The Russia and Ukraine is another reason why we have to get off our dependency on fossil fuels. Imagine where we'd be right now if, in fact, Europe was, in fact, energy free of fossil fuels and we were in a situation where it was all renewables. It'd be a different world," end quote. Okay, wow, let's unpack this. First, climate policies that pretend we can do without carbon, they are the causes, they are the reasons of Russia and Ukraine, as we discussed in prior episodes of the Far Middle podcast, not the other way around. Environmentalism and the myths of zero carbon and reliable wind or solar at scale, they drove climate change policies. Those climate change policies resulted in places like the EU and increasingly what's going on in the United States to shutter their domestic energy industries and retire nukes, coal, and natural gas power plants. Wind and solar, they don't work at scale, so something has to plug the gap. And in the case of the EU, what plugged the gap was Russian natural gas, thus created a dependency on Russian natural gas in Europe. And prices and inflation rose due to these damaging climate change policies. That made Putin feel emboldened and made him feel strong economically and strong from a geopolitical perspective. He felt and he did have energy leverage against the EU because of the environmentalism and climate change policies. So he moved on Ukraine. And in the end, if you want to stop Putin, you grow domestic natural gas and oil. You don't kill it. Duh. It's pretty basic. Second, I'm saying that it would be a different world if our entire grid was wind and solar. That is certainly true, but not true how the president thinks it would be true. Because the reality would be if our grid was entirely wind and solar, it would be dark and anarchy would reign if that were the case. That's because wind and solar don't work at scale, you can't build enough of them, and they aren't going to be on-demand sources of energy and electricity like natural gas, coal, or nuke plants would be. Now, this is all basic stuff, but even at the highest levels of government and political parties, you still see this fantasy strongly rooted, even when you're mugged by reality with things like the Ukraine. And that brings us to our next topic to discuss. With climate change policies being the root causes of Ukraine's woes and the root cause of inflation, and of course, the root cause of high gasoline prices, you've now got California averaging over $6 a gallon for gas, and the U.S. average is over $4 a gallon across the country. Now, this has become a big problem, a massive problem for the Democrats and the current administration. So what do? They end up applying the most tangled logic that you can come up with or think of. So let's walk through this. Let's see what they've come up with. First, let's shove climate change policies that kill domestic energy down the economy's throat. Then, since energy affects the cost of everything, let's watch inflation rage out of control. But initially, let's pretend it's transitory. Then we can blame COVID. Now we can blame Putin, even though the same climate change policies caused Putin as well. Wait, so now the public, right, they're not buying the inflation and gasoline price excuses. They're getting a bit antsy. They're getting angry. So let's do something else because the midterms are coming. We're politicians. And we'll do just about anything to hold on to power and avoid accountability. How about we propose something with a great name? Let's come up with the Gas Rebate Act of 2022, which will send $100 back to every American every month when gas prices exceed $4 a gallon in the nation. That's exactly what three representatives in Congress, one from California, one from Connecticut, and one from Illinois, proposed in the House in March. And it's not just that they're all three Democrats, but ironically, or perhaps not ironically, all three hail from states that are hugely anti-domestic energy. You saw this whole behavior by government and those in power. This all started with pandemic and the relief checks, that whole process. You had a situation, now we've got another situation with gasoline, but the situation we had with pandemic, where government caused the economic pain via mass shutdowns. They then sent some of your money back to you and acted as if they were doing you the favor. Now it's precedent and common practice. They cause the problem with bad policy. They inflict the pain on the citizenry. And then they give some of our money back to us and act like they managed a crisis, not of their own doing. People, if you're in politics and you want to win elections, you're going to need to come up with something better than this. Goodness gracious. And by the way, that brings us to our next topic, our next dot. Everybody's talking about gas prices and gasoline, but as the price of oil and gasoline and natural gas skyrocket from these climate change policies and the subsequent results like the Ukraine and inflation, the price of everything goes up. Because I just said it a minute ago, but I've said it many times in the past, everything you use in life is tied to the mighty carbon atom and energy. Now, here are some things that are already skyrocketing beyond just gasoline. Plastic, especially those containers in grocery stores for pre-made foods and the like, because plastics are petroleum-based, which means the price of the food in it will go up when you buy food to eat, and everybody eats. Fertilizer, price of fertilizer is going up since natural gas prices went up, and natural gas is a feedstock for fertilizer and things like ammonia. Fertilizer is used to raise animals we eat and grow the plants that we eat, so food prices are going to go up even more. Electric vehicles and electronics, the price for those are going up. Why? They need things like nickel, and much of that comes from places like Russia, and it's a very energy-intensive process to extract it and process it. So your Tesla and your smartphone, they just got more expensive. Power and electricity, the price of those are going up because the grid uses natural gas and coal and wind and solar, all of them going up in prices, and the costs of making them are going up as well. So your utility bill just got more expensive. Your mortgage is going up if you're buying a house or if you've got an adjustable rate mortgage for the house that you're in. Why? Because energy costs drove rising from climate policies, they drove and they raised overall inflation. That made the Fed fall behind the curve, so to speak, and they have to hurriedly rise interest rates or raise interest rates, which is going to increase borrowing costs when you go get a loan from the bank. And your car got way more expensive because all these things I just ran through drive up the cost of a car. The plastic to make it, the electronics to control it, the gasoline to power it, and the loans to finance it. You still want to be in a carbon-free world? You still think it's going to be the nirvana that it's been promised to be? Now, since we're on the topic of inflation, let's jump to our next dot and review some sage advice on how to manage this inflationary mess caused by our inept energy policies. Our friends at Bloomberg, right, they are certainly in the eco-warrior category, and they certainly can't get enough of our climate czar. They're big admirers of him, and they are big believers in the zero-carbon economy. They ran an opinion piece recently, and the title initially got my attention right away. The title was, "Inflation Stings Most If You Earn Less Than $300,000. Here's How to Deal." Okay, I read that and I just knew this was going to be good and had to share it with you on the Far Middle podcast. So here was the advice, and I'm not making this up. Okay, this is not a parody. It was meant to be a serious piece. First, to deal with gas prices, sell the car. Ride public transportation. Even though fares are way up, the author says that they are up less than gas prices, at least. Second piece of advice, to deal with food prices, the author says to explore. And I saw explore. I said, now what does that mean exactly, to explore when it comes to food? Well, it means cutting out the, quote, middle creature, end quote. Huh, you might ask? Well, that is leftist speak for going vegan, the middle creature being, I guess, the animal that you would eat. Because the author notes that meat is up in prices more than beans. Then the weirdest advice of all. If you've got a pet, forego medical care for the dog or the cat. And it also notes in this advice column that chemo for pets should be avoided for both the ethical reasons and the cost reasons. So strange to see some advice on managing inflation when it comes to chemo treatments for pets. And then the piece ends with an odd thought, and I'm going to quote here. Try to be as flexible and creative as possible. Scientists tell us our brain plasticity will improve by trying novel things, end quote. Now, I can't wait to see what the advice will be from this author when it comes to electricity. Maybe something like candles made from sustainable supply chains of wax or something like that. What a fun world this zero carbon inflationary environment is ending up to be. Ditch the car, kill the cat, adopt a celery-only diet, and enjoy the increased brain plasticity. Sign me up for that. By the way, the author is a professor in economics. And speaking of economics in the world of business, you all know I've been a consistent advocate for capitalism and the free market and the business community. But nothing or no one is perfect. And I feel an obligation to call out a few entities in the business world today that are exhibiting behavior that is less than upstanding when it comes to doing business with Russia. And the government, our government, the EU government, is allowing them to do so. Now recall, this administration keeps patting itself on the back along with its EU compatriots about how these Russian sanctions are unprecedented. You keep hearing that unprecedented term being thrown about. And only essential items may continue to be sold to Russia. You see that term, essential. That seems impressive to hear in tandem, and you'd think not much business is going on between Western companies and Russia, but you'd be wrong. So here is what apparently is essential when our government and big business assess things with Russia. Potato chips, men's razors, ice cream, cars. And these are continuing to be peddled by the biggest names in business. I mean, you've heard of these corporate names. Some of them are European, some of them are American. this is unprecedented when we won't stop selling the Russians ice cream, when the French business interests won't stop making cars inside Russia. It's a bad look for business, and it's a bad look for the EU and US governments. And doesn't this just remind you of the lockdowns in this nation from pandemic, when only, again, quote unquote, essential workers were allowed to get out and function and earn? Remember that mess when the government and the bureaucrat got to assess who was essential and then by difference who was tagged as non-essential? How collective and oppressive and thick-headed. It's deja vu all over again with these unprecedented sanctions. I guess unprecedented isn't what it used to be. You know, these topics, this episode, constant listeners, just reminds us that the world moves fast, but unfortunately time moves faster. So it is time to call it a wrap on episode 46 of The Far Middle. And I want to conclude this episode with a quick remembrance of a really funny, witty person that did commentary and satire better than just about anybody. He passed away a few weeks ago. His name was P.J. O'Rourke. And his best piece of all time, he was very prolific with his writing, but his best piece of all time, in my opinion, was a book that he wrote. The title was Parliament of Whores. And you read it, you'll probably agree it's funny, even if you don't agree with some of the conservative leanings and views on government that he had. And a lot of people might disagree or object to this comparison, but P.J. O'Rourke reminds me of another individual out there that I think does some pretty good stuff that's typically funny, even though I don't always agree with him, which is Bill Maher. So, you know, P.J. O'Rourke more on the conservative side, Bill Maher more on the liberal side, agreed with a lot of what these guys say, disagree with a lot of what they say as well, but the two of them sort of remind me of one another. And even though you might not be agreeing with what Bill Maher or O'Rourke were saying, you always sort of, they got a chuckle out of you one way or another. Now, P.J., he worked at National Lampoon, which I used to read in my younger days when I was a very young adult to try to get smarter. I thought that if I was reading National Lampoon, I would get smarter. And it did make me a bit smarter, but not nearly enough. And that wasn't the fault of National Lampoon. That was on me. And P.J. O'Rourke also worked at Rolling Stone magazine. So think about that. You had someone with a bit of a conservative leaning working at Rolling Stone as a writer. So it showed you that there was a time long, long ago when that music magazine had some balance in its reporting, but that hasn't been the case for a long, long time now. And at National Lampoon, things really get interesting because PJ collaborated, worked closely with another guy at National Lampoon. His name was John Hughes. And this is, yes, the same John Hughes of 1980s movie fame, the great writer and director. John Hughes wrote or directed some of the greatest movies ever. And a lot of those movies, all those movies that he either wrote or directed, fall right in my sweet spot of what I was watching when I was growing up. So here's just like a murderer's row of, think of these hits that basically he either wrote or directed. Vacation. So Clark Griswold, the whole Vacation and Griswold family, that was John Hughes. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles with Steve Martin. Uncle Buck, he had a great collaboration going on a number of movies with John Candy. Weird Science, so you guys remember Chet in Weird Science, the older brother, the older abusive brother. What was his quote? How about a nice greasy pork sandwich served in a dirty ashtray? I think everybody had a friend who had an older brother like Chet at some point in their lives that grew up in that time frame. Pretty in Pink. Pretty in Pink is a great movie, but an even better soundtrack. That's probably, if you're thinking through, maybe we have to do this on The Far Middle someday, the greatest soundtracks in movie history. Pretty in Pink would be up there, believe it or not. It's sort of just like a smorgasbord of 80s alternative music. You had the Psychedelic Furs with the title track, of course. OMD was on that soundtrack. Echo and the Bunnymen, New Order, I think In Excess had a song on that soundtrack. So if you want a great soundtrack, just great music from 80s alternative music, buy the Pretty in Pink soundtrack. 16 Candles, right? Remember 16 Candles? What was the famous line there from Molly Ringwald? I can't believe they forgot my birthday, or something close to it. I'm not exactly quoting there. I'm leaving a few key words out of there. And then there, of course, from John Hughes, the two pinnacles of 1980s movie greatness. I think two of the greatest movies to come out of the 80s. Ferris Bueller's Day Off being the first. How many times have you watched Ferris Bueller's Day Off and all the different scenes and quotes and just sort of the little idiosyncratic acting that's in there? Just a great, great piece of work with respect to Ferris Bueller's. And then my all-time favorite, even I rank it ahead of Ferris Bueller's Day Off, The Breakfast Club. I think the greatest movie about high school ever. I lost count of how many times I've watched that thing. If you're sort of channel surfing through the day on a weekend or something, you come across that movie, it just stops me in my tracks. I have to watch the rest of it. It's just a weakness that I've got. So we lost John Hughes, I think over 10 years ago, which is hard to believe. And now we've lost his colleague, PJ O'Rourke. But the two of them just did some phenomenal work. And now we get to look back and enjoy on what they've done, despite them not being with us anymore. Well, hey, I hope you enjoyed this episode. Time to go for now. Order your copy, buy your copy of Precipice. All the net proceeds go to a great cause, the CNX Foundation Mentorship Academy. Hope you enjoy the material. Follow me on Twitter at Nick Deolius. Check in the nickdeolius.com website from time to time. Always posting new information there. Talk to you in a week.